Good morning. It's Saturday, January 31st, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Abby Frucht, winner of the Iowa Fiction Prize for her short story collection, Fruit of the Month. Abby Frucht is the author of five novels, Snap, Licorice, Are You Mine, Life Before Death, and Polly's Ghost. She's been a recipient of two National Endowment for the Arts fellowships, a New Voices Award from Quality Paperback Book Club, and several citations for notable books from the New York Times. A finalist for Narrative Magazine's First Person Fiction Contest, she won the K.W. Levine Short Nonfiction Prize from the Council for Wisconsin Writers and has a new personal essay forthcoming in Real Simple Magazine. A member of the National Book Critics Circle, she has written numerous reviews and essays for the Boston Globe, the Village Voice, the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and other publications. Abby is a faculty member of the Vermont College of Fine Arts. She lives in Wisconsin. When I spoke to her in December, I asked how she became a writer.
Well, I came to writing at a very young age, and I mean, it's a little embarrassing for me now to look back at the poems that I was writing when I was 9 years old and to remember the kind of indulgence my parents gave me in those endeavors. And I had these little notebooks of poems with drawings that I made. And I guess one of the most important things that happened to me when I was in that phase was I was at a day camp, and I had brought my little notebooks of poems with me very proudly and showed them to my counselor and was, you know, considered myself a poet. And one of the boys in one of the other groups at day camp found my notebooks and tore them to shreds and spread them all over the little parking lot area. And it was devastating to me, but I made my peace with it very quickly because the boy's counselor came to my house that night and visited to apologize. And I've never forgotten that. And I've never forgotten it as a writer, because it is true that you have abundant attachment for the work that you do, but that doesn't mean that the world is going to view it with the same kind of affection, yeah, or even with any respect at all. And that was maybe a really good lesson to learn at that tender age, because that's the way it is.
And sometimes you just have to start over too.
And sometimes too, I mean, one of the other lessons to take from that is it's not someone from the outside who is bringing a surprising and distressing judgment to our work or our work in progress. It can be ourselves. Mm. So I might, you know, work on something for over a year and then sit down one day and be able, for whatever reason, to read it in a particularly objective frame of mind and say to myself, this is all wrong. This doesn't work. This isn't what I thought it was. Or this isn't any good, period. And it's a hard thing to do, but it does happen. Hmm. And I'm always aware when I'm working on something that I am loving working on, that that does not necessarily guarantee that I'm going to love it the next day or the next week, right, or that it's even going to work at all.
Which is, you know, kind of a good flip side to that lesson. I mean, if you'd never learned that lesson, I think there's a lot of potential for falling in love with your work as you're working on it and deciding it's perfect.
And also there's a lot of potential for deciding that because we're involved in it when we're writing it, that means that it is an engrossing piece of work. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just the work itself is engrossing. The process by which we write is engrossing. That doesn't necessarily mean that the piece itself is engrossing.
Right. So you said you used to, well, you were nine, but I know that you also used to be a poet when you were a bit older than nine. Do you still write poetry?
No. I've tried on and off, not with much success. I really don't know very much about poetry. I don't read enough of it. When I do read it, I enjoy it. And I guess when I hear a really wonderful poem and when I hear really wonderful poets read, as I do here at Vermont College, I feel the same kind of envy I might feel for somebody who plays the piano really beautifully, that it would be lovely to be able to do that. But I don't think that's going to be part of my life.
And that's interesting. So you sort of see it as a genre that's so separate from what you do that you'd need to sort of devote a whole nother piece of your life to figuring it out?
It has to do with knowledge and education, and I would have to re-educate myself or go back to school and learn what makes a poem. Mm. I mean, when I was young, and I guess when many writers are young, we're content to write out of our own expectation of what a given genre might ask of us. But there is a discipline out there, and there are certain parameters there that have been established, and I don't know what they are for poetry. I would be writing into and out of a void.
Mm. Mm-hmm. What inspired you to write your first novel?
First and foremost, just the desire to write.
Well, you did stories first for a while.
I did stories and the novel simultaneously.
Oh, okay.
And I was just a writing person. I don't think there was anything I saw or did. I did write a short story, and the novel did emerge from that short story. So I might say that the writing of that short story introduced me to this pair of characters, Ida and Rupert, really bizarre names, and that they became the principal characters of my novel. I remember feeling when I started that novel that I wanted to employ multiple points of view because I didn't think I could sustain it just in Ida or Rupert's voice. So, in other words, it was more like, I think I would have to, if I were to be totally honest, I would say that the inspiration for that novel was the desire to learn how to write a novel. Mm. You know, it wasn't as if I had a story I wanted to tell. It wasn't as if before I began to write it, there were characters whose experiences or voices I felt a need to explore. Once I got them down on paper, I liked them, and I liked living with them, and I enjoyed playing around with them and seeing what they did and experimenting. But there are a lot of different points of view at work in that novel, and so I think it was sort of a training grounds for mm-hmm. me. When I wrote Licorice, my second novel, there was a much more personal kind of choice that I made to write that novel as opposed to any other. And that had to do with the town I lived in and the condition that my marriage was in and other things. It was a very personal choice.
When you find yourself writing a longer piece now with a single point of view, do you find that it's, you know, more onerous to sustain a single point of view the way you sort of looked at it at the beginning?
I have written a few longer pieces with single points of view. I don't find them that much more difficult to do, but I think that they end up being less successful. It's hard for me to sustain a first-person voice in particular over, you know, 200 or 300 pages and make it remain interesting mm-hmm. without the reader feeling sort of claustrophobic, contained by one voice. I do like the first-person point of view, and I do like working within a single point of view, but mm-hmm. It's more difficult to sustain the book.
Okay.
There was a period of time in my life when I was reading novels which reflexively all seemed to alternate among points of view, and it seemed to me that that was a sort of formulaic approach to the novel, where we would necessarily see a single event retold by three mm. or four different characters, and that was supposed to be the aesthetic engine that drove the novel. But it began to seem almost cliche to me, and it was something I guess I made a decision that I didn't want to do, only because I was seeing so much of it. That didn't necessarily mean that maintaining a single point of view over the course of 300 or 400 pages was easy or worked. It didn't mean that it worked, but it did mean that I just saw so many books that operated by switching points of view that I decided I didn't want to do it. Mm-hmm. It became boring to me, and it became too predictable for me as a reader.
So how does and I know this probably varies from novel to novel, but is there a certain way that a novel generally starts for you with an image or a line or an event?
I don't think there's any one thing. I mean, it's a matter of finding a tone and a voice that moves me and that I think will carry me through on a page-by-page basis through a story. And it also does help to have a story you really want to tell or something you really want to talk about, you know, as a writer. Mm-hmm. There are some people who come to writing with the language being the engine that drives them to writing, and there are other people who come to writing with the story itself. And I wish that I had... that I resided more in the middle than I do. Mm-hmm. Because it is hard to fashion a compelling story out of just words, out of just language. I wish I had sometimes a whole slew of stories that were begging to be told.
Now, that's an interesting point. For many people that I've talked to, the story arises out of the process of writing and out mm-hmm. of the language. And that's hard. You know, mm-hmm. sometimes you feel like you're writing and there's not a story arc taking place, you know. So do you find that you end up working more on the plot, the story arc, in revision, or...?
I had an interesting discussion along these lines with my agent very recently, and it has to do with a book that I was working on, and I don't know if I will even get back to it or not, but it's a novel in progress. And she pointed out to me that, or I guess through the course of our conversation, I realized that some of the emotional and psychological resonances that I was taking for granted were being understood by the reader were not being understood. And there were things that I thought were going on that were not really being communicated mm-hmm. adequately to the reader. And so she said, you know, it is, you know, it would be helpful to sit down and employ more plot. And my response was something like, yeah, okay, I can make this happen and this happen and this happen. And she said, no, I don't mean necessarily making things happen dramatically in the book, but what I mean is that I want there to be lines and sentences and passages that communicate directly to the reader what's the parameters of every event in the life of the character. Hmm. So that the emotional underpinnings that I thought were already sort of implicit in a scene or in a given moment needed to be made explicit. Mm-hmm. And it was a really useful exercise to have that conversation and then return to the work in progress. And without trying to ratchet up the plot, because I don't like that kind of writing and I don't like that kind of story, where the plot is sort of contrived in order to make the reader care, it was interesting to go back and see how can I make the emotional and psychological underpinnings of this story apparent to the reader and not be so wedded to the need to be subtle. Mm-hmm. And it was really helpful.
Well, once you've started on a piece, do you have anything that you like to do to get to know your characters better or to get to know who they are better, or does that just sort of happen as you write?
One thing I like to do, and which has been helpful to me, is to sort of secretly base the character on a real person that I know. And I'm not saying that the character is actually representative of that person, but that my response to that person, my sort of visceral response to that person, becomes my visceral response to that character in progress. So the person, him or herself, would never recognize him or herself. And nobody who knew that person would know that that was the person who was the one I was using. But there may be somebody who I'm secretly afraid of, or who I secretly admire, or who I have, who I'm puzzled by, and I will take that emotion, the puzzlement, the fear, the admiration, and bring it to this character so that I have something to go on in my mind, some kind of reference point that I can use as I'm watching that character go through an ordinary day in their lives. Mm-hmm. My characters do tend to move through ordinary days. They don't move through extravagant days or unusual days. Their days are fairly ordinary. And I guess it helps to have a certain emotional reference point that I can bring to them in order to witness their ordinary days. Mm-hmm. It also is true that, you know, I bring every story or every page or every novel through abundant numbers of drafts. And part of that is because I need to better understand the character on many levels, on concrete levels and on abstract levels. Sometimes I'll work with a character for months before I realize I have no idea what he or she looks like, you know? Mm-hmm. Or I'll work with a character for months without having any backstory for them and not knowing where they came from. And that, to tell you the truth, backstory isn't really important to me as a writer. I almost think it's an artificial kind of parameter that fiction writers assume is necessary for their readers to have. I don't find what we call backstory all that interesting. Mm-hmm. And nor do I find the whole concept of motivation of a character very interesting. I much prefer to just watch somebody or plunk somebody down in a given situation, again, not an extravagantly unusual situation, and see how they behave and see what they make of it.
Do they ever surprise you?
Not really. The world surprises me. The things that happen to them surprise me. The times when natural laws do not obey themselves surprise me. Mm-hmm. I'm writing a story now, or I sort of abandoned a story now, but I assume someday I'll get back to it, about an experience I had when I bought a print. It was an unusual print, and I won't go into detail here, but it was at a sort of fraught time in my life, and I began to feel that the print was haunting me, so I hid it in my attic. And then I didn't want to throw it away, because I felt that to throw it away would be dangerous. I had this superstition of this print. And so I brought it here and sold it at the auction at Vermont College. And I don't know what became of it, and I don't know what became of the person who bought it. That was a really awful thing to do. But so I'm writing a story about a woman who comes into possession of this very same picture, and it has a certain effect on her life. The picture doesn't really begin to haunt her. It actually has a physical consequence. So I don't believe that a character necessarily needs to change. I think the world can change, and I think the world does change. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's all that realistic to imagine that people always change when things happen to them or around them. Sometimes the messages or the tension comes from the fact that we stay the same and everything else is different, especially now, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's just that I'm more cognizant of what's going on in the world, the big world around me. Maybe it's kind of nice to imagine that we remain who we are over the course of a 20, 30, or 40-year period when everything else is in a whirlwind. Mm-hmm. And the people we love, we like to imagine, too, that, of course, they're going to make changes and their lives will change, but that doesn't mean that they themselves change in their souls or make decisions about how to be a better person. You know, that's just not realistic.
Maybe this would be a good time for you to read from your
work. And I will start out by saying that this is a piece of fiction, but it does come from my childhood.
Okay, and I'll just say this is Abby Frucht reading from her story, The Dead Car, which was just a finalist in the Fall Fiction Contest for Narrative Magazine.
And it's actually, I think, part of a novel. I'm not sure. "You have lovely penmanship," Cynthia told me in her funny, but to me, intoxicating speech, which sounded like cracked reeds threaded along lengths of fishing line. Sometimes the reeds hung crooked on the taut, clear lines. Other times they struck each other like chimes. The two of us were upstairs in the room called the little room, which I had wanted for my own but was Cynthia's now. With my brother, Sagittarius, I shared a much larger bedroom downstairs, which had its own bathroom and also a walk-in closet, larger by half than the little room, which was really a dormer tucked into the eaves. A steeply slanted ceiling scarred with peeling wallpaper made it romantic in my eyes, as if one might die of consumption there, cold but ecstatic. It wasn't cold. There was the same baseboard heating as everywhere else. For a bathroom, Cynthia needed to go downstairs, circumvent the gold-flecked guest bath adjoining the dining room, and use the one off the laundry room instead, where we shampooed Ike, our dog. The window in the little room held a yellowed vinyl shade. The carpet appeared to have been paced back and forth on by somebody trapped in a starved, fitful reverie. As far as we knew, no one else had ever actually lived there before. A freshly made-up cot, narrower than my twin bed, took up nearly all space. Cynthia kept most of her clothing, her white, short-sleeved uniforms, her church dress and hat, even her nightly washed underthings and the hosiery with the reinforced toes, which she draped across the rung of a hanger to dry, next door in the playroom closet, alongside the old Hoover vacuum cleaner. The wire hanger left stains on her garter belt and bra. Her nightgown was kept on a hook behind the little room door, from which also hung a mirror the size of a photograph. You had to draw aside the nightgown in order to see yourself in the damaged sheen. things, eyeglasses, yo-yos, tended to become lost in the little room. Once, I was eating my snack up there and lost the spoon. I was sitting on the cot. I didn't need to do anything out of the ordinary to lose the spoon. To this day, I can't remember even putting it down. It was made of white silver with that scratched matte finish you rarely see anymore and had a slender, deep trough. Dannon yogurt was new in the U.S. then. None of my schoolmates ate it yet, but the fruit on the bottom was just like jam. I loved swirling the yogurt in with the jam and putting my tongue to the tapered spoon before the swirling was done, taste-testing the gradual changes in flavor the more I stirred, the color deepening, the sour giving way to sweet, until at last I cheated, lapping at the final bubble of jam before stirring it in. But then, when I stood up, the spoon had disappeared, never to be found. That was the way things went in the little room. Nobody had ever said that about my penmanship before. Until then, I had thought of it only as handwriting anyway. "I won't be grading your handwriting," our tall, blonde teacher had recently announced. Mrs. Higgins often scratched at her armpit while writing on the chalkboard. Up went the hand, wielding the stick of chalk, and in no time the opposite hand darted sideways to scratch at the nubbly underarm flesh. She had recently married a man with the same last name as hers, so had gone from being Miss to Mrs. Higgins as if the marriage were only half consummated. "Handwriting is associated with personality," I exclaimed to my brother in Mrs. Higgins' chirpy manner, in my imagined high heels at an imaginary chalkboard, my hands scratching at my armpit as I scribbled the words, "You were born with your personality, therefore you were born with your handwriting." Our mother poked her head into the playroom while I was putting the flourish on the G. A week later, we discovered an actual chalkboard installed where the imaginary chalkboard once had been, with cartons of chalk, a crisp wooden yardstick, and two erasers. Also a school desk of the type you open up to put books inside. I didn't like our toy schoolroom nearly as much as I'd liked our imagined one, which I missed much more than I missed that silver spoon, although it didn't seem lost, just layer upon layer, peeled forever away. "Wanda, she have lovely penmanship, too," Cynthia added, in what the people at the agency called her mixture of pidgin and proper English, but which I can't for the life of me duplicate here on this page. I just don't know how. When I attempt to convey the rhythm and vocabulary via proper English, of which in the agency's note both P and E were capitalized, it sounds silly and awkward. But if I try for the pidgin, of which the P was lowercase, I get too many things embarrassingly wrong. Our parents referred to our new maid's patois, which in French means to clumsily handle or paw.
Thank you. So, because you said this comes from your childhood, it does, you know, that always sort of makes one wonder how much is from your childhood, how much of that detail are you kind of inventing now, and how much is...
Almost every bit of it is...
Is recollected.
I mean, I'm recollecting it through a certain lens of, you know, wisdom that I've acquired and through a certain kind of social lens that I've acquired over the years. But I'm pretty sure that although I have made the choice for the sake of artistry to make it a little harsher than it was. My real parents were not nearly as blind to the kinds of things that they were doing as the parents in this book will end up being. And there were no terrible consequences, as far as I know, as there might be in the book, as there have to be in the book if it's going to succeed as a book. So I have decided to exaggerate what I remember, but the details themselves, the actual physical details and the conversations of what I've read so far are fairly... close to what actually happened,
yeah.
If my memory is to be believed or trusted even by me.
Well, since we're talking about that story, I was just going to ask you, because it has just been named a finalist by Narrative in their fall fiction contest, and your work has won other awards, including the Iowa Fiction Prize. So I was just curious if you enter a lot of contests and if you recommend that to writers who are trying to get their work out there.
I don't necessarily recommend it. I think it's really nice for validation to know that for instance, this story was a finalist in the narrative comp, but that doesn't mean it's going to be published there. You know what I mean? So it spent a lot of time there being read, and I'm happy that it was chosen as a finalist, and it gives me a little extra spark when I someday sit down and ask myself whether I really do want to write this novel or not. And it gives me something to say in my letters when I send it out. If I send it out to other magazines for publication, I can say this story was a finalist in the narrative contest. But the problem with contests is that, well, sometimes they don't result in publication. They cost more money to enter. And they do cost, and that's how, you know, and that's of necessity. Literary magazines have to bring in some money somehow, and in a large way they bring in money is by having contests and having reading fees. And so, you know, when I enter a story in the narrative contest, I'm also thinking to myself, I would like to support Narrative Magazine. So rather than send them a check for $50, why not send them a check for $20 along with my story and then have a chance of winning this, you know, contest right. as well. So I think getting your work out there and getting it read is important whether you're submitting to contests or just submitting for general publication. It's harder to win a contest, of course, than it is to, you know, well, maybe that's not even true. You know, publication is really hard these days across the board.
I remember hearing one of the editors of Glimmer Train saying that the main difference for them was there's just such a deluge of submissions for contests, and so perhaps you have a stiffer competition in that way. But
maybe so, and it may also have something to do with, you know, if a certain kind of story won their last recent contest, they don't want the same kind of story to win their next contest, so there may be an element of selection involved that's not generally at work. When you're just sending something in for general submission. Mm. I'm a finalist in another contest now with a different story, and when it was named a finalist, I was required to withdraw it from any other place where it was being considered. I hadn't realized that this would be required of me, and had I known that, I probably wouldn't have submitted it to the contest because it's a lot of work to submit things, and it takes a lot of time, and a story might be out at a given magazine or three or four magazines for 4 to 6 months before you hear something. And so to wait 4 months and then withdraw it on the off chance that you might, you know, win an award, it's like I said, had I known that, I wouldn't have. So you should be careful about what's going to be expected of you if you do enter a contest.
Right.
And also, it doesn't mean the piece will be published, you know.
Do you get feedback from anyone before you submit your work?
I used to get more feedback than I do now. If it's a big piece of work, I can show it to my agent and get some feedback from her. And I also have a friend here, Lori Alberts, who I've gotten to know really well, and we happen to be really good readers for each other. So I get feet and give. It's a reciprocal arrangement. Mm. And I really like reading her work, and I like hearing what she has to say about mine.
I think that's great to find one person whose opinion you respect.
Mm-hmm. My mother used to be a good reader for me, but for various reasons she no longer is, which I lament. You know, I mean, it's too bad. She just doesn't have the concentration anymore that she used to have.
Yeah.
She doesn't read fiction anymore.
You have a story titled Is Glistening, that's actually one of my favorites of your pieces. I'm wondering if you mind if I read a paragraph from it, and then we can talk about it. In this scene, the character Mrs. Salk is about to go on a boat ride with her husband and a hired boatman while they're on vacation.
They're on their honeymoon.
Feeling it imprudent to take such a valuable object onto the water, Mrs. Salk had laid the heavy silver bracelet, link by link, across the dresser top. Each flat, solid link was fashioned into a poppy, in whose absence her arm turned thin and girlish, a sapling of an arm. On second thought, she removed her watch as well and zipped the watch and the bracelet, along with the matching brooch, into a pocket of her cosmetics bag and tucked the bag beneath the invisible flap in the suitcase next to the passports. Then she put on a zippered canvas jacket, her formidable tortoiseshell, sunglasses, and the very same hat she'd been wearing before. What I love about this story, which is true of a lot of your work, is the care that you take with details. And I mean imagery, but I also mean just sort of the details of how a character operates, you know. And in this case, Mrs. Salk's move to hide her jewelry is very recognizable, you know, for anybody who's been on vacation and doesn't want to leave something in the room and doesn't want to bring something with. But the details, that particular bracelet with its poppy links, and I loved her sapling of an arm, and the invisible flap in the suitcase, these are very specific to her story. I'm just wondering if you can talk a little about the use of detail to enrich a story.
The reason that I put that bracelet there and that I invented that bracelet, I actually didn't invent it, it's a real bracelet, but the reason I used that bracelet and was attentive to the way it looked is because it does turn out to be very important in the story. I'll give the story away here, it doesn't really matter. The fact that she takes that jewelry off saves her life. Right. And that's something that she may never realize, but I think the reader recognizes that that's what saved her life. I guess she does realize it at that point when she reads later on that the fisherman who took them out on the boat robbed and murdered another newlywed couple, very similar to a couple very like herself and her husband, and dumped their bodies overboard. But she learned this just several weeks later after her own excursion with this guy. And if I hadn't made the bracelet very precise, that moment and its importance might be lost on the reader. Mm-hmm. I wanted the reader, and I actually do too mention that bracelet in the very opening paragraph of the story, because I want the reader, I wanted it to serve as a sort of signpost for the reader. It's not just embellishment. It's me saying to the reader, you'll be familiar with this bracelet. Here it is. That way when you come to it again, you'll understand its importance. Mm-hmm. You know, you'll recognize it.
What about when you're not using signposts and that you just, you know, like the piece that you read, the spoon and the way that it has the, you know, sort of scratching design in it.
The matte finish.
Matte finish. Mm-hmm. Everything's just so specific, and I think that's so important. And I'm wondering, what does that give to the reader?
I think it allows, for two things. It allows the reader to have an immediate physical investment in the story, because I think a story needs to operate on, you know, both a literal and a figurative level. And that spoon might also serve me a purpose later on. I mean, first of all, I use it so you can imagine holding the spoon and the weight of the spoon, and I wanted it to be an object of some physical value that was lost, not just an ordinary spoon, so that the importance of the fact that things are lost gains significance by virtue of that spoon being having more weight than an ordinary spoon. But the book itself, if I ever write it, will be about something that is lost. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I might be able to go back to that spoon, to the silver, to the scratched matte finish, to the weight of it, and use it again as a signpost and use it as a way of evoking the idea of loss, mm-hmm. or the idea of the mystery by which things disappear from our lives. And because I've created the spoon, it will come in handy to me in that way. It also will remind me when I go over and read the book, you know, when it's in progress and I come to that spoon, I'll say to myself, oh yeah, this is a book about something that's lost. I forgot that. Here I am on page 185 and I've forgotten that I want to write about something being lost, and that's to be the central thrust of this narrative, and so I better go back over it and, you know, remember why I put that spoon in there and remember why I said that the little room is a place in which things are lost. So I knew when I wrote that was going to be a theme of the book, that I might forget it, because I know how I operate, and you know, I might write this over a period of 10 years, and that a way to remind myself would be to make that spoon more important than just any old spoon.
Okay.
But it is a choice you face, because I don't want to pointlessly embellish objects in a story. You know, you don't make things beautiful or interesting just for the sake of making them interesting. You make them beautiful or interesting or strange for the sake of bringing that to the story itself, yeah. You know, inserting beauty or strangeness into the life of the character.
So you might just have made it a spoon if it weren't going to hold that kind of
exactly.
significance.
Mm-hmm. Or I might not have put it in at all.
At all. Right. Right. Or you just have her eating the yogurt without mentioning the spoon.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When you start a new project, do you set goals for yourself as far as either quantity or progress or somehow figuring out how you want to move through it?
To be honest, my working habits have changed a lot in the past couple of years, and I don't really know why. It used to be a lot easier for me to set goals for myself in terms of where I wanted to be 6 months from now with regard to a particular piece of work. I don't tend to set those goals anymore because I know I won't reach them because I'm moving around too much among different projects. And I don't, like I said, I don't know why that is. I don't really like the fact that that's the way it is. I would like to be able to ask myself to move through a certain thing and get something done this next year and actually finish an object, you know, a story or a novel or an essay or whatever. But if I do, I will have to require it of myself in a way in which I didn't used to have to do that. Mm-hmm. It used to be that I could very contentedly work my way through any given project until I reached the end. And I never worked on simultaneous projects, except that I would be teaching and writing. But I would never write more than one thing at the same time. Mm-hmm. And now it's very hard for me to stick with one thing. And that's a scary thing that I have to deal with as a writer. Mm-hmm. I don't really like it.
Mm-hmm. It could just be a phase.
It could be, but it might not be. I don't know.
Your novel, Polly's Ghost, concerns a woman who's died and is observing the world, and specifically her son, among other people, from a sort of afterlife. I was curious if it was a challenge to write about a ghost or if that was fun.
It wasn't terribly challenging to me, but only because I think I made a fairly explicit decision about how to treat the ghost very early on. And the ghost isn't a very complex character. The human characters, the live characters, are the important ones. Her son, to me, is the main character of mm-hmm. Polly's Ghost. And she, the ghost herself, is really only a figment of his life and a method by which I approach his life. So it wasn't necessary for me to make her a complex character, in other mm-hmm. words. And so all I really had to do was to decide how I wanted to convey ghosthood and how ghosthood would be affected by the particular personality of this particular dead person. So I knew a little bit about her personality. She's a fairly flat character in the book, I think. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but she just represents a sort of giddy maternal instinct in the book, and that's all I really needed her to do.
Okay.
And so that's why it wasn't challenging. Had I wanted to write a book in which the ghost would be the main character and be a complex figure, it might have been much more difficult. I mean, I guess the idea of the ghost in Polly's Ghost was more, the challenge there was not with regard to the character of the ghost, but with regard to the way the existence of a ghost would influence the shape of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
And her existence in the novel gave me a certain license to move through the real world that I might not have had the ghost not been present. The ghost was a kind of omnipotent
right.
creature that could see, you know, beyond walls and into people's minds and could see through layers of time. And had I not had the ghost in the novel at all, I would have had to just assume that kind of ability on the part of some omniscient narrator or on the part of myself, the writer. And it was more fun for me to take those qualities and those abilities and sort of give them a body, although she didn't really have a body right. in which to exist.
And she kind of has the ability to affect other people a little
yeah.
bit, too.
Yeah, she does. Her presence was more of a sort of, it had an influence stylistically on the book.
Right.
Almost more than it had on the actual events of the book.
What writers have been important to you, either personally or through reading their work?
No one personally, because I don't know that many writers, well, except for Laurie Alberts, because she's the person I read and who reads me when we have work in progress, and I love that relationship, and our friendship, and it's very important to me. There are certain women writers of what I consider to be high intelligence who also have a poetic way with language, and who also have a certain kind of cruel humor, mm-hmm. who have been not influential to me as a writer, but who have meant a lot to me as a reader, and who have cemented at times when I've had difficulty reading fiction, reading their work has reignited my commitment to literature. And some of those writers would be Doris Lessing and Margaret Drabble, and more recently, the more recent people who are writing works that I've been reading recently would be Valerie Martin, and especially this year, Roxana Robinson's novel Cost, which is really beautiful. And I like those books because of the way the intelligence of the author is part of the is layered and woven through the visual layers of the world in which their characters are moving, and without any apology. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I will also say that, and this is something I wouldn't have believed I would have said a few years ago, but now it happens to be true. One of the reasons I am so fond of Roxana Robinson's novel Cost right now, and one of the reasons I picked it up and read it in the first place, was because the event in the novel, it has to do with a well-heeled, well-educated family in which the older son is a heroin addict. It's a very tragic story, but it what had relevance to me because there are certain things going on in my own family's life which made me want to read the book, you know, just to see what I could learn and to be able to relate to it. And I used to hate when people said to me, I can't relate to this book, because I thought, well, why do you have to have something in your own life that's immediately relatable to what you're reading in order for it to be a valid reading experience? But I did feel the urge to read that book precisely because what was happening in it was of an immediate concern to me. And I loved it in part because it taught me things, and because I was already in that zone.
Right.
And so I read a lot of addiction memoirs this year just because I felt that they held my interest in ways that other books that were not immediately relevant to my family life or a set of circumstances just didn't, mm-hmm. or couldn't. I also, and a lot of my friends agree with me up here now, the fiction writers of a certain age are having a harder and harder time finding things we like to read. It used to be that almost every book I picked up, and I was selecting them carefully, would move me and would hold my attention. And now it's almost, it seems to me that, and I ran into many other people who feel the same way, that if we have one or two books a year that we love, it's not enough, but that's the way it is.
Now, are you talking about yourself as a reader, or are you talking about the new works that are being published?
Both, really. Both. If I like to be contemporary, I mean, I like to read the works that are being published. So I'm constantly sort of searching via looking at reviews, via, you know, seeing who has a new book out. You know, trying to choose the books that are going to really capture my attention and interest as a reader enough to literally keep me reading them. Mm. I mean, I'm reading in a household with other people in it, and it's very easy to become distracted. Mm-hmm. And I like to be with my boyfriend, husband, whatever you want to call it, but he likes to watch TV. If I have a really good book, I can lie there and read my book while he's watching his TV and not be distracted by Law and Order or whatever it is or whatever's on. But if I don't have a book that really has me, I'm going to put it down and watch the television show, or have one ear on the show and one eye on my book.
Right.
And I don't really like reading that way. But it has been true that it's been really one or two books a year that are able to really hold me. And I think that has to do with the sort of thing that's being published. And I also think it has to do with my habits as a long-term reader and the things I really like. And maybe I have a certain old-fashioned sensibility that isn't being addressed by what is being published these days, and I think that's too bad, because I know that there are, I have many, many women friends who have given up reading fiction because they can't, and these are not writers, all of them, but some are just, you know, women in whatever profession, doctors, bankers, whatever, who just don't, who have too difficult a time finding a novel that really moves them to bother anymore. To bother looking. And that's a harsh thing to say. But what it also means is that when I do find something that I love, it's huge. And that book will stay with me for a long time. And it's one I'll tell my friends about. Like Cost by Roxana Robinson, for instance, as I've mentioned. And like Valerie Martin's books.
Right.
That I really admire. And I don't strive to write like them. I don't think I could. And so it's not a writerly thing. It's not like I'm coming to them and they're going to be my influences. But it is that I want literature to survive, and for a certain kind of reader.
Now, do you think, looking back, say, 10 years to the books that you were reading and perhaps loving at that time, if you were to pick those up today, you'd still feel that way on a first read?
On a first read?
Yeah.
I don't know. Probably.
So I wanted to ask what advice you might have for writers who are stuck in their work or have trouble moving a piece forward.
Yeah, there are two basic ways I approach that problem in my own life, and they sort of occur simultaneously. And one is to just really stick to it and hunker down with the work, and I mean on a daily basis, because tomorrow I might not work on that piece at all. But when you're there in front of your computer or whatever it is you're working on, force yourself to engage and try to work right through a problem. Try to ask yourself the kinds of questions you need, the objective questions that you might bring to a page. You know, it depends what phase of writing you're in. Sometimes you have a hard time identifying the tone that's going to drive a story, and other times you have a hard time because there's something turning in the plot and you don't understand how to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
And generally I feel, I guess, that when it's a question of the tone or the voice, it really helps to sit down and work yourself through it and write your way through it. When it's a more empirically based question, like how am I going to get this character from one place to another, plot-wise, it helps me to just leave and go to work out in the gym or take a walk with my dog or do something physical. And traditionally, I mean, in my own life, when I'm out there working out, those answers do just come to me. And I guess it's because I've been working through them subconsciously. But physical activity is a very important part of my life as a writer. It's no longer surprising to me when I'm in an aerobics class or taking a walk and I suddenly have an insight about what to do about a particular question I've had in the book. And what's really fun about that is sometimes I'm lying in bed at night or just lying around and an answer will come to me. And whenever that happens, my body moves. I'll sit up, or I'll turn over if I'm lying in bed, or I'll sit up and grab a glass of water or something, you know, so it's as if my body has sort of made that connection between physical movement and that kind of insight. Huh. So it's like, and you know, when I'm trying to come to an answer, when I'm in motion, it seems as if the motion is what catalyzes the insight. But when I come to the insight, when I'm still, my body still creates the motion to go with the insight, the moment of insight. It's kind of a fun thing to notice. I have no idea if it happens for other people or not. But also I think, you know, leading a well-balanced life is important. Writing isn't all there is. And sometimes you're stuck because you'll never get through a particular moment in a particular story or a particular book. And it helps to recognize that, too, when you're stuck because maybe this book isn't the right one for you to be writing at this given time, or maybe you're not the right person to write it, or maybe it's more trouble than it's going to be worth. And that those are those times when you have to ask yourself, how devoted am I to this work? How much do I want to struggle through it? Like, I had a discussion years ago with a friend of mine who told me that when she was vacuuming the floor and there was a penny on the floor, rather than stoop to pick it up, she would vacuum it up. Okay? And I would always stoop to pick it up. Okay? And it was a penny. And so how much do you want to go out of your way to retrieve what's going to end up being of not much value, you know, and, right. and maybe those periods of being stuck are going to force you to ask yourself that question, you know, what is the potential for this piece being worthy of the kind of struggle that I'm bringing to it? And a lot of it has to do with what you want to write mm-hmm. or what you think people want to read.
Will you tend to sit with a struggle for a long time before you give it up?
Well, I used to sit with it for longer than I do now. But I think I've reached a decision over the course of this actual last couple of weeks that I want to make an effort to sit with things a little longer now. Mm. I don't think it's very productive to move between five pieces at once. Life changes too much. And, you know, if you have five pieces on the burner and you're working on them every other month, your feelings about that piece are going to change so much over the course of its being written that you're going to lose any sense of coherence, or the central message will be lost or camouflaged by new things that have happened.
And you might also be stepping over to one piece when the one you were working on before is just about to have some sort of breakthrough.
Exactly. And it's a method of sort of postponing the moment of reckoning. You know, can I make it happen or can't I? Mm. Or even, do I want to send it out or don't I? You know, you might be too frightened to finish it because you're afraid that when you finish it, you have to send it out and have somebody reject it. And that's a painful prospect. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the hope and the expectation that we have when we're working on a piece and it's just safely in progress is really a wonderful feeling to have. But we have to give it up when we send it out, knowing that then its value is being measured in the eyes of other people. And that's a hard thing.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been enjoyable.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Abby Frucht. Tune in next week to hear an interview with novelist, short fiction writer, and essayist Shu C. Before I move on any further, I will just tell you that Abby Frucht's name is spelled A-B-B-Y, F-R-U-C-H-T, if you want to find her on the internet. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group, and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. For more information, visit AutismSupportDaily.com or call 985-8773. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Senator Bernie Sanders will host two town meetings on Sunday, February 1st, with renowned environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. Sanders and McKibben will host a brunch in Woodstock at the Town Hall Theater starting at 10 a.m., followed by a meeting at the Brattleboro Union High School Auditorium at 2 p.m. to discuss reversing global warming as we develop a sustainable economy. Dr. Kevin Dann, author of A Short History of American Destiny, shares an unsettling, surprising look at past Lake Champlain events and discusses their profound implications for our present moment. This will take place at the Burnham Memorial Library in Colchester on Monday, February 2nd, from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Author Luella Bryant reads from her book, While in Darkness There is Light, at the Kellogg Hubbard Library in Montpelier, on Tuesday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. Vermont author and farmer Burr Morse will talk about his new book, Golden Times, at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier on Tuesday, February 3rd at 7 p.m. Renowned naturalist, educator, and Silence of the Songbirds author Bridget Stutchbury describes the migratory routes and endangered wintering grounds of birds that spend summer in Vermont. She'll be at Billings Hall, UVM, in Burlington on Tuesday, February 3rd at 7 p.m., and she will also speak at the North Branch Nature Center in Montpelier on Wednesday, February 4th at 7 p.m. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by this week's interview with Abby Frucht. In discussing her work, Abby explained that, to her, specific detail achieves two purposes. First, it allows the reader to have an immediate physical investment in the story. And second, it can have a larger significance, serving a figurative function in the narrative and acting as a signpost for the reader. In the case of her story, The Dead Car, the detailed description of the spoon that was lost may later be brought back to remind the reader that this spoon speaks to loss generally, not just the loss of a certain object, but other kinds of loss as well. In your own work, study the descriptions that already exist and see if you can use specific detail to your advantage, not simply to embellish, but to help readers experience the work more fully. Try to find objects that already exist in the work and then heighten their function through detail. It's best to avoid wedging in symbols. Try to allow significant details to arise organically. A copy of this prompt will be included in the description to this week's podcast. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live every Saturday morning at 9 at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or events for next week's Bookworms calendar, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.